Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author.
Today's investors expect more than a transaction. They want a relationship. Show how your firm merges EQ and IQ with Orion's BFI 20, a new shareable assessment developed by Dr. Daniel Crosby that provides you with emotional and attitudinal insights into clients to facilitate more meaningful investing conversations from day one. Get started today at orion.com/BFI20.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. I am joined today by Dr. Emily Cushell, who is a senior financial planning education consultant at eMoney, a financial wellness champion, and an adjunct faculty member at NYU, where she teaches a course on money and relationships. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel. So nice to be here.
Yeah, great to see you again. I ran into a conference with two-time guest, Dr. Sonia Luter. One of our favorites of the show did a recent episode on love and money and her workbook on that topic that was just great. So I know we're both big fans of hers, but I am writing a new book right now, very painful, and financial wellness will feature prominently in it. And I had never, I'm a bit embarrassed to say, really gone down the rabbit hole with financial wellness. And once I started to, one of the things that struck me was just how little consensus there was around the term financial wellness. There's sort of all these adjacencies, there's related terms. And I really liked your definition of it. You, in one of your research papers, you give your definition of it, and you even say in the paper, look, I was very thoughtful and intentional about this definition. So I'd be curious to have you share that definition and how you arrived at it and sort of the practical difference it makes in your work.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, I couldn't agree more. If you search for financial wellness, it will lead to hundreds, if not thousands, of different websites and programs and products and really everything in between. I think financial wellness has been definitely a buzzword over the last few years. And what we did at eMoney is we decided to look into these different interpretations of financial wellness, actually going out and asking people, what are some of the themes that people think of when they hear financial wellness? And so really, as a result of some of those efforts, was able to come up with what I would call a short form definition of financial wellness and then a long form of it. But the short form really being in having this healthy relationship with money. But I want to get into the long form because it gives a little bit more context to it. So financial wellness, the way that we see it, has many layers, but really at its core implies this healthy relationship with money. It's a positive state of being, and it's all coming from your relationship with your finances. But the impact of financial wellness goes into a whole host of aspects in your life. So we look at it from mental, emotional, physical, relational, and even spiritual health. I think one of the key things that we uncovered and that we keep in our definition in this long form is that there's no specific number that, specifies that you have reached or achieved financial wellness, but rather it's ultimately achieved through taking action and just understanding your own financial situation and taking the steps to improve it and ultimately maintain it. In addition to kind of those thoughts around financial wellness, we also know that it just means different things to different people. And it's based off of, age, income level, your aspirations, your goals in life. But each one of these, right, they can lead to this sense of preparedness and confidence and security. And something that we talk a lot about is financial peace of mind. So we were really intentional in the way that we developed this and trying to make sure that we were covering all of the complexities and the dynamic nature of financial wellness, but then boiled it down to, that positive state of being in our, again, kind of this short form definition that we're using.
Yeah. you know, if you look at some of the more conventional definitions of financial wellness, it's something more akin to like an ability to meet current and future financial obligations. And that's really all about a number. And so if you had enough wealth, you would tick that box. Like, I mean, you could have enough money to meet all of your current and future obligations, but really be very unwell with respect, you know, with respect right. to sort of how well adjusted you are and how comfortable you are, your sense of enough, your sense of abundance, you know, being giving, 100 other things. So it really isn't, you know, I don't know that numbers have nothing to do with it. Certainly there's a sort of a minimum threshold, but it's much more than a number. And I think any definition of financial wellness that doesn't understand that is severely lacking. In a recent piece, you talked about three actionable steps for incorporating financial wellness into planning conversations. And I was wondering if you could share some of that practical knowledge with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to go back to your previous point, I think you raise a really good, you know, question and consideration around wellness and well-being. There's really great work out there from the CFPB who has their scale and definition of financial well-being. Ju actually looks into the difference between well-being and wellness, and he centers it a lot on health and then looks at well-being as something similar to being able to be able to provide for yourself, to, you know, be able to have a secure financial future. And that has a little bit more of a monetary aspect to it. So I think just for something of food for thought for people as we look into, are we using some of these terms, you know, synonymously, or are these some of these, there are nuances between them when we look at wellness and well-being. So food for thought for conversation purposes going forward. But yeah, you're right. You know, with all of this broadness around financial wellness, we still generally use it as a marker of satisfaction and health. And it's ultimately important for financial professionals to be well prepared for these types of conversations and be skillful in the way that they're doing that. I think that a lot of it begins in the initial conversation with clients. Step one is in the, you know, information gathering stage, being really keenly aware and curious, looking for alignments in somebody's stated goals, in their values, in their actions. Because what we know is that a lot of us have really great ideas of what we would like to have and what we would like it to look like and be. But oftentimes, if we look at our behaviors and our actions, sometimes there's some obvious misalignments to those. And being really keenly aware of where is it that we see alignment to those values and the goals that somebody has, and where are they misaligned, and where can we help take that information and extract it and be useful and intentional and motivational in those conversations with them. Now, while I say that it starts kind of in the stage one of those conversations, it is absolutely something that requires check-in and evaluation and looking at progress and updating those conversations and the financial plan as you're doing so, because life changes, as we know, and sometimes we're not meeting with our advisor as often as our life is changing. So also encouraging that clients reach out and let us know, have there been any, you know, kind of notable changes that are also going to perhaps change the way that we have aligned these goals and values and ultimately kind of our version of financial wellness. But within that, it's all really about having a tailored action plan and a tailored plan for those clients, and really emphasizing that what we do today is going to really matter for our future financial wellness, and keeping that in mind, being future oriented. We could see that this could possibly be a little challenging for some of our younger clients, of course, especially as we're looking out at retirement and other things that may seem really, really far away. But just encouraging that day-to-day actions and the actions of today can have an immense impact on that financial wellness and the goals of tomorrow. So making those connections and making sure that we kind of motivate them through those aspirations. And then I think one of the last ones is being and encouraging to be that touch point in those decision-making processes for people. Again, we come up against so many of them where some of them we feel really confident and we feel as though, hey, we've got this. And others, we can say, gosh, I wish my financial advisor was on speed dial right now. And I think encouraging to understand those situations and to understand your own behaviors and actions that are going into that, and helping guide them, helping them find some of the steps to take to put those decisions into action, and then motivating them to follow through these, you know, these different check-ins.
Yeah. So as a follow-on to that first piece, I love the idea of sort of, you know, drawing out their values. That's something we're working on right now at Orion. Drawing out and making those values explicit, and then looking for incongruence between sort of stated values and behaviors. But it strikes me as a potentially thorny conversation to say, like, hey, look, you value X, but you're not acting in such a way that X is made manifest in your life. Do you have any, you have, I think, multiple master's degrees in counseling and in therapy. Do you have any tips for us about how to gently have that conversation for advisors to point out an incongruency in a way that doesn't, you know, sort of raise the alarm?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that you can do is honestly have out a piece of paper and have somebody think about what is that goal and help them articulate it. Because here's one of the curious things about money and goal setting and these aspirations is we have an idea of, again, kind of what we would love it to look like, but articulating it to somebody and articulating it to ourselves can be quite challenging because most of us really haven't been taught how to do that. So helping them articulate, you know, essentially what those goals are that you're working towards, whether that's short term, long term, or anywhere in between. So write those goals down. Now, step back one step from there and say, what is it that you believe you're doing today that's working towards that goal? So it's also drawing in a little bit of what we know as solution focus. Let's find some things that you're doing correctly. But in that conversation, more often than not, you'll also start to understand what you're not doing to get to that ultimate goal. So then uncovering that, making sure that there's no shame or judgment behind it. It's okay. We still have our aspirations over here. We're just uncovering maybe what we're doing right and maybe some things we could be doing better. And then setting those action steps and making them incremental. Oftentimes, if we make them just a little bit more bite-sized and easier to get to, we stay more motivated. So drawing on some of the psych as far as like the motivational piece, some people will say, you know, 10% more, 10% more, and that allows people to build. So thinking about what is it that you could do this week, this month, an action step that would help move this forward, and then start to understand how all of that compounds on getting us closer to this goal. So looking at the goal, finding all the great things that you're doing and saying, awesome, and then probably uncovering some things we could be doing a little bit better, and then just putting that plan in place, putting those action steps together collaboratively, right? Like we want everybody to be a part of this. And if we come up with those ideas ourselves, we oftentimes feel more motivated because we have a little skin in the game doing it that way. That's one idea that comes to mind.
Yeah. We could have a whole another hour on this, but I would also encourage the advisors listening to check out the motivational interviewing literature. You know, motivational interviewing is a whole sort of set of techniques about how to have conversations that spur behavior. And I think that's a skill that would serve most advisors well. So I'll just drop that bomb and have people do that homework. So, you know, one of the things we did a survey recently with our advisors, and one of the things we find that advisors are looking for right now is personalization. And I think that financial psychology, behavioral finance are really well positioned to help with this process of personalization. In one of your papers, you cited your own research showing that a majority of planning clients think that the advice they receive is too generic, and that 72% are looking for a financial advisor who understands their specific financial stresses and comes up with bespoke solutions to address them. So I'm curious, you know, about your vision, like what's the role of financial psychology in meeting the demand for personalization, and what do some of these solutions look like?
Yeah, I think it's personalization is at, you know, top of mind for so many people. E-money included, everybody is looking into personalization. And so we did some research here to understand if there are any disconnects in those definitions or experiences of personalization. And so we went out to the advisors and we went out to the consumers and said, hey, tell us a little bit more. And it defined that for us. Tell us about it. What we found is that for personalization purposes, when we looked at it for advisors and from their perspective, many of them cited that personalization had to do with identifying the client's goals and putting actions behind the client's goals, which is absolutely sound financial planning. I think most of us would agree with that. However, it's really kind of here that we see the heart of some of that disconnect. It's in the type of goals that people are talking about. So for advisors, we generally found, that advisors were looking at this from a monetary standpoint, whereas the consumer or the clients were looking at it from exactly what we were just talking about, is helping me reduce the stress, the anxiety, helping me cope through these times. They even dropped in words around coaching. They talked about having somebody help them through those volatile times, also building the confidence and making their own decisions. So when we talk about goals, even in just the personalization of goals, it looks like we were having a little bit of a different conversation. And people are looking for somebody that considers all aspects of my financial life, both monetary and financial and non-monetary and non-financial. So that seemed to be really interesting. But it's not to say that the financial aspect isn't there. So when we looked at it, we also saw that consumers across all demographics actually mentioned budgeting, especially to help mediate the impact of economic volatility. And that was a top priority for personalization on that side of things. But the number one personalization piece was around helping coping for stress and anxiety and these feelings that we have around those goals and our financial journeys.
Wow, it's incredible. I love that first piece. It's like we have to make sure we're optimizing for the same thing. We're having a conversation around goals, but we the financial industry are projecting our goals perhaps of saving X for retirement, when their goal is sleep better at night, enjoy time with my grandkids, you know, whatever the case may be. And of course, as you mentioned, there is a financial component to sleeping well at night and having that time with the grandkids. But it's so powerful to think about, you know, are we on the same page with our clients and their goals? And are we even framing those goals in a way that's salient and speaks to that client? That's really compelling research. I had a conversation yesterday with a large firm, and a subset of their advisors were very skeptical of sort of the power of behavioral finance, the power of financial psychology. And they were asking me, you know, what, basically saying kind of prove it to us that this stuff matters. And I was thankful that I had prepared for this conversation because I had some of your research from the role of financial psychology and financial planning today that looks at the benefits of financial psychology from a number of different angles. You know, there's benefits for clients, there's benefits for advisors, and then you also speak to some of the barriers to implementing financial psychology, which I found, frankly, a little surprising, some of the barriers that you put forth. So I'd be interested to have you speak about this paper a bit. What do you see as sort of the advantages to each party, and then where are we falling short, or what are the roadblocks?
Yeah, so I would start by saying that there are a lot of people who don't really know what the planning experience looks like, what it entails, the expectations around the planning experience. And oftentimes we find that some people may have some out-of-date ideas about what that is. So for me, just a personal opinion, is that we as an industry really have to showcase the value of financial planning and the value of financial planning with the psychology aspect in there, going beyond just the investment and performance and really encouraging what we know is impactful and beneficial about understanding the person. So I think it's really on us as an industry and advisors and others to help clients and prospective clients know about the experience that they would receive in this planning relationship. And for many, many planners, when it comes to the psychology of financial planning and as these conversations are coming up, that many of them are probably doing some aspect of it already. For most people, we understand that financial planning is relationship-based, but you may not actually know that you should be highlighting it. You should be talking about it. You should be, you know, letting people know this in the expectations of that relationship. And you absolutely should. So one of the things that we can start to do is we can let people know about this. We can do it through the conversations that we're having with them, in our expectations of this relationship. We're going to dive into understanding the relationship of you and your money, and we're going to use that to understand the financial plan. We can do it in very explicit ways. We can also do it in ways that are a little bit more implicit, and we can build that in through asking thoughtful questions. We can, of course, guide them through kind of these financial journeys that they may not even know that they are on. But kind of going back to people who may not know the impact of financial psychology, we can also build that into some of our branding, letting people know that this is a different experience. The way that we relate to people is different, and we can set up a framework and a scope for them. Again, these expectations, letting them know that we can deliver on these services. But ultimately, when we look at the benefits and the impact of financial psychology, so much of it is going to be that people who are thoughtful and skilled and trained in financial psychology, or at least seeking that education to be, is we often can get to the root of the client. We can get to their why, we can get to their motivation. Oftentimes clients feel more heard, they feel more seen, they get this more personalized experience as we're talking about, and that plan is more reflective of them. They see themselves in the plan, they see themselves in the journey. Ultimately, that's a very validating experience. It's a very motivating experience to see yourself inside of that. Whereas traditionally, we see it a little bit more transactional. And I think setting up the expectation that this is going to look and feel different is really important. And even if it's not explicitly said, I think those feelings of the personalization and validation come through when somebody goes through the psychology kind of skilled version of the financial planning process.
So a question for you. Transactional was the word that was in my head as I was thinking about this next question. I think that there's a certain subset of probably every advisor's clientele who almost wants, call it an old school transactional relationship. Like, look, I don't pay you to be my best friend. Like, I don't pay you to shrink my head. Like, I want you to allocate my assets effectively. I want you to report back to me on how we're doing. I want you to be a subject matter expert, and then I want to call it a day kind of thing. Now, for people like this, highly analytical, transactional, whatever we want to call it, is part of personalization just giving them what they sort of ostensibly want? Or do we say, look, there's richness and there's value here that you're not experiencing if we treated this transactionally? And do we have sort of a duty to kind of sell them, I guess, on the BFI approach?
I mean, I think that some of that is in a discovery together. There may be an opportunity to work in the best interest of the client, and the client is saying, this is exactly what I want. But I think that it is our duty to at least bring up the value of this work, right? Because oftentimes people may not even know that this work exists. They may not understand or have heard of the value. And it does feel a little mushy, and it feels a little like that's not what I'm here for at all. But I do think that there are approaches and practices that facilitate FinPsych and, you know, some of these softer aspects in a way that doesn't feel so mushy. And like, I went to my therapist today. I think there are ways that we can get people to talk about their money in a personal way and still uncover their values and motivations. And it doesn't necessarily have to feel like you had a whole therapy session. I think there are different skills and different ways to facilitate financial psychology. But I do find that there is value in at least exploring whether or not that is a fit, and then adjusting your services based off of what you deem is appropriate in the way that you facilitate financial planning, of course. I mean, all of this comes back to your services and your boundaries as well. But opening up that conversation, but I think there's different ways of doing it. I think, again, there are really explicit practices, and then I think there are some that are a little bit more implicit, and people may not even know that it's occurring.
So I think this next question is a furtherance of this general conversation. And when I was looking at the impediments to sort of implementing FinPsych approach in your paper, two of the three top impediments are sort of a soapbox of mine. One of them was getting clients interested in this type of planning. And another one of them was marketing these services. I'm a big believer that nobody is asking for this, right? Like nobody is like coming to their financial advisor saying like, wow, like I want a thorough, you know, I want a thorough vetting of my personality and my risk composure and my anxiety levels and all these sort of more psychologically minded elements of the planning process. Now, you and I and listeners to the show understand the enormous value of that. But to me, it's almost like you got to bury the vegetables under the cheese or something kind of thing. Like you've got to sort of not hide, but like it should just be embedded. Like it should be part and parcel of this. And I know that some firms really put it on the marquee, right? Like this is what we do. Like you're going to talk about your emotions. You're going to talk about your feelings. I have a ton of respect for that, but I just don't know if the average person is looking for that. But I think if they experience it, they'll love it, right? Like if you come in and you have an advisor who cares deeply about you and has a really psychologically informed discovery process and you know, is eliciting these values from you and deepening that relationship, I think once people experience that, they love it and they feel it. But I don't know that marketing it as such is very effective. Where do you kind of fall down on this, having it be more transparent or more opaque, sort of what we're doing?
I mean, I think it comes down to, again, your services and what you want people to know exactly about those services. I think there are those that say we are taking a financial therapy, therapeutic lens, and we want you to know that in case that's what you're seeking. And that, to your point, is absolutely okay, right? If that's what you're looking to do and you want people to know that. However, I tend to agree that I don't know that everybody is saying that's exactly what I want. And so finding ways to infuse it into your planning process and into your client relationships, where again, they may not even know that they're experiencing it, is a way that I see that we can get into more planning conversations. We can get into more of these relationships and have a greater impact and be doing some of these skills and people don't even know. I also am encouraged that hopefully at some point our technology services and other services can also help make this more adaptable, more available in some way that helps planners who are maybe hesitant to, you know, adopt it themselves, give them an opportunity to have a little bit more guidance that's readily available through technology. This is just something that I find really interesting about where we're at right now is we have so many great conversations around FinPsych and therapy and counseling and all of these really great skills and initiatives that we know and professionals coming out and saying this is so important. But where we do still see an area of opportunity for growth is for technology to come in and help with that, to help scale that, because right now, for some, that's still a very manual process. We say you should try out these skills, or here's an assessment and, you know, different opportunities to bring it to your firm. And then we leave them to go to work on Monday and say, try it out and good luck. And, you know, refer back to that article that you read. And so I think there's still a lot of opportunity here where we can actually help people bring this into their work and make it something that is, you know, not hidden, but it's definitely in there. But it helps to bring it into these conversations. And I think there's, again, a large area of opportunity to help others.
Yeah, I think it's great that, you know, you and I both work for tech providers, and we're able to bake FinPsych into the very sort of fiber of the client experience in a way where it's delivered with great consistency. And, you know, technology is sort of so ubiquitous that it becomes easy to sort of embed some psychological truth within a technological process, and it's not experienced as other. You know, it's not as experienced as like, open up, here comes some, you know, stuff that's good for you. It's like, you know, it's just part of the process. So, you know, I've heard this mentioned many times by planners and advisors that sort of every sort of financial planning conversation is at its sort of center, some variant of, am I going to be okay? And your research suggests that people are not able to answer that in the affirmative. You know, I found it a little scary that some of the research you did found that around half of consumers use words like stress, overwhelmed, worried, unprepared when asked to describe their financial lives. I'm curious what role financial psychology plays in helping people increase their confidence to say, yeah, I'm going to be okay. And then the flip side of that, when people really aren't going to be okay, you know, when people haven't adequately prepared or, you know, when they're not where they need to be, what are your thoughts on sort of delivering that message in a way that can spur action and hope and not overwhelm and further stress?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to questions of, am I okay? Am I going to be okay? For me, this is a kind of a prime time opportunity for advisors to build or increase the trust that they have with the client. I think understandably, we all want to feel stable and secure. We all do, and we should, right? In working with financial professionals, but it's also important for us to remember the fragility of trust. Now, this can come in times of volatility. This can come during times of underperformance. This can also just come from a conversation with somebody who seems to have it a little bit more together than us. And it can undermine the trust and the relationship that I've built, or that sense of security in feeling okay. So I think it's really important for us to demonstrate that security, because if left without explanation, sometimes we come to our own conclusions, for better or for worse, about if we really are okay. And when it comes to these words that people are using, like stressed and overwhelmed and worried, those are really heavy words. Those are, you can feel the weight of them. But this is an opportunity to possibly reframe and start to help change the narrative by, I think, infusing some of the really great work that comes from positive psych, which I think is really awesome. People who are starting to talk about bringing positive psychology into the work of financial planning. So just for anybody who may be unfamiliar about what that is, just kind of quickly, it's a belief of people wanting to lead more meaningful and fulfilling lives and feeling, you know, like they are cultivating what is best for them. And if you're ever looking to learn more, of course, Martin Seligman is going to be the go-to person for this, and Flourish and others, where he talks about this. But here he also talks about this notion of disputation, which I think is really, really interesting. Sarah Acevedo and actually Martin C., they talk about how to infuse some of this into the financial planning process. And I really liked it, especially when we're looking at changing the way that we're thinking and connecting to this. So one of the examples that they gave about, you know, disputation is that, let's say that you went to the mall, you overran your budget, and now you think, I am just the worst with money. I can't manage it. This is terrible. And we start to associate some of those negative words to it. Now, in the way that we look at it from disputation from this example specifically is, yeah, you did. You blew your budget. You made a mistake. But it doesn't mean that you can't manage your money. It doesn't mean that this is absolutely destructive. We can change those beliefs and we can go back and say, actually, you've been doing great, right? You've been doing really great for the last few months. You made a mistake here. It doesn't throw everything off the rails. And Seligman talks about and addresses the power of optimism and how positive psychology can help people bounce back from these situations. It can energize us and energize our actions and shows really the significant impact of if we promote more of an optimistic perspective for our clients. So while we know that these words are being used and they probably are very representative of people's experiences, and it's not to take away from that, but I do find it as an opportunity again to build trust and to help see if we can bring more positive connections and encourage more positive actions in our conversations and in the financial planning process.
Yeah, seconding the insights of positive psychology, the work of Dr. Seligman in specific, his PERMA model. So he has this sort of five-part model for sort of happiness and wholeness. And just real quick, it's positive experiences, which is like fun, right? Like having enough fun in your life. It's engagement, which is deep work. R is for relationships. M is for meaning, and A is for advancement, like, you know, getting better. He really has sort of encapsulated what it takes to have a happy, good life. And this is a framework, sort of a mental lattice work that I use with clients all the time to just like on the back of a napkin, 1 to 10, like, are you having enough fun, right? Are you doing deep work? Are you spending enough time with the people you love? Are you working for something bigger than you? Are you better today than you were yesterday? And if something's lacking, where can we meet that need? Something as simple as that PERMA model from the work you talked about is such a powerful tool in talking to clients, helping them identify deficits in their life, helping them spend their money in more meaningful ways. I can't agree with you enough there. You know, one of the things that I liked about the way you framed that "Am I okay?" conversation is instead of it being like a great, like, you know, let me talk this person off the ledge, let me console them or whatever. You framed it as an opportunity for deepened rapport and trust. And I think another opportunity is the fact that advisors encounter clients so often around change, periods of change and upheaval, you know, divorce, death, retirement. And you cite some research around retirement that I thought was fascinating, because retirement is another one of these opportunities. It's another one of these forks in the road. And you cite research that suggests that for some folks, retirement is a time of great depression and isolation, right? It's a really, really tough time. And for others, it's a time of great happiness because they have increased autonomy, they have decreased work stress, they have more time outside. What is the role of an advisor in transition periods like that? You know, use retirement as an example. And how well versed do we need to be in the research to be able to help our clients effectively navigate this beyond the number? Because I think for so long, it's been like, I'm your advisor, I'm going to help you get to this number. It feels like our role needs to be and can be much bigger than that.
Absolutely. I think one of the first things going into conversations around something like retirement or these really, you know, monumental life transitions is to suspend the judgment and suspend the assumption that you know what it is that somebody wants, right? And honestly, for some, we find out that while they have some expectations about retirement or, you know, whatever life transition it is, that they don't quite have it defined, right? Whether that's monetarily or non-monetarily. And so what we found was essentially that you know, whether or not you've been looking forward to this or not, it can still trigger some stress and some anxiety. And for a lot of people, we see this with job loss, we see it with retirement, and for, you know, kind of other areas of this, looking at it from the side of identity as well, recognizing that this may have been your identity and you've worked so hard doing this that there, I was doing some reading around it that for some, it feels like you were the person and then the next day it feels like nobody knows who you are anymore. It's a great sense of loss and it can be a great sense of loss of yourself. So also understanding that as we transition and as we look at all the great and wonderful things and we have people consider what is it, you know, monetarily that you would like your life to look like, your lifestyle during retirement, also having them think about the other considerations of hobbies and what do you plan to do? Tell me a little bit what you plan to do that, you know, the first couple of months that you have off. And oftentimes it's, you know, people have some ideas around travel or you know, really kicking their feet up or whatever version of that is. But then take it a little bit further than that and ask to explore, okay, what do you look to do over the next couple of years? And this is where some of that newness of the retirement can start to wear off. And we can help them think about some of the other factors that are related to retirement here and that transition. Because again, some of it can lead to, unfortunately, these sense of loss and depression. And I had the opportunity just very quickly to work for a retirement planning firm just straight away from a round of grad school, one of the couple in there. And I worked for this retirement planning firm and they were usually 10 years from retirement or in retirement. And it was noticeable the people that had thought about retirement beyond the numbers and had those conversations about what that meant to them and where they were kind of going to find that next sense of value and belonging, et cetera. And for some, that would mean, you know, doing a little bit of extra work, getting involved in their community and et cetera. But those that had not been, you know, kind of involved in some of those conversations or been a little reluctant to think about it, unfortunately, sometimes you could see it. You could see it on their face. You could see it in the way that they carried themselves. And it was so important for us to address those conversations. We just had the opportunity to kind of anecdotally see people walking through the door and notice the impact of some of that lack of preparation. So encouraging financial planners to understand, again, kind of all aspects of the financial life and specifically around these major life transitions.
Yeah, I think this is just such a great opportunity, right? We tend to talk about and think about retirement in sort of a one-dimensional frame sometimes as just sort of like, yay, now I'm going to hit the links and no one can tell me what to do. But, you know, work provides us a lot of structure and it provides us a connection with our coworkers. It provides us advancement and financial rewards. There's, you know, work's not perfect and there's a lot that we don't love about work, but there's a lot of good that it does in our lives. And if you're not intentional about filling the void left in the absence of work, I think you're in trouble. And advisors are in a great place to help clients consider something they may not have considered themselves. Well, Doc, it's been wonderful. Thank you for everything. If Emily is an incredible follow online, where can we follow you online and sort of keep on top of your research and other things you're sharing?
Yeah. So always feel free, of course, on LinkedIn. And then the other opportunity is through eMoney Advisor. We have a great blog called Heart of Advice blog where a lot of our research is posted out there and the great work that we're doing inside of eMoney. And of course, that is been reshared on social media and LinkedIn and all of the great work that comes from people like Daniel and others, of course, are out there as well. So follow all of the wonderful pioneers, including, you know, Dr. Luter and others that we've referenced in this discussion.
Dr. Emily, thank you so much for sharing all this with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.